Welcome to my Love Life Podcast, episode number 228, Gluten Intolerance and Celiac Disease. It's March 6th, 2024. I'm your host, Lisa A. Lundy, author, blogger, YouTuber, motivational speaker, and who knows. I am also a member of the Newsweek Expert Forum. What I do is I help people be happy, healthy, and well-loved, even when life is extremely difficult. As my disclaimer, this podcast does not constitute medical or therapy advice in any capacity. There is no longer any music for my podcast intros or outros. I invite you to join the movement and please get other podcasters and social media content creators to ditch the music when combined with voice, which is a benefit and helpful to people who are hard of hearing or who have hearing loss. End of non-musical intro. Gluten intolerance and celiac disease. Oh, this is a very important topic, and there's some misinformation floating around, as there has been for quite some time. Before I get into this, if you are listening to this podcast right now and you are feeling hopeless or that life is too hard for you, or if you are feeling suicidal, please call 1-800-273-8255 or call or text 988. That's the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. There is help available. Please make that call or text. Also, as I mentioned in my non-musical podcast intro, nothing I say in this podcast is intended or designed to be medical or therapy advice. Now, gluten intolerance and celiac disease is something that I'm coming up on my 25-year anniversary for learning about this and getting into it because I had to. So I will say there have been some significant changes in the gluten-free market, Sadly, however, we still have some very, very problematic things going on. So hopefully this will make some things clear for you. Now, if you have a chronic or ongoing health issue or some symptom, this could be the underlying reason why you're having that health symptom, which when I get into a few of the medical things, that hopefully you'll have a light bulb moment. So gluten is found in certain grains, which can be used in sauces and lunch meats and you name it. Gluten is kind of ubiquitous. Gluten is not in all grains, though. Gluten is in wheat and rye and barley and spelt and kamut, bourgeois, which is not a grain, but other grains as well. So there are many sources for gluten. It's not limited to wheat. Oats is controversial, in my humble opinion. Now, 24 years ago, there was no controversy to oats. 24 years ago, oats were taboo, strictly forbidden on the gluten-free diet, no exception. That was just the way it was. Yet, a few years into it, things began to change, and I won't even get into all of that. You'll have to make your own decision about oats. I'm telling you, there are differing opinions about oats. Now, celiac disease is where we're going to begin. And celiac disease, by the way, is also referred to as celiac sprue, S-P-R-U-E. However, that's not as common as it used to be. So celiac disease is an autoimmune disorder that affects the digestive process of the small intestine. What happens when a person who has an active case of celiac disease or is diagnosed with celiac disease, whether it's diagnosed or undiagnosed, this is what happens. If someone has celiac disease, diagnosed or undiagnosed, is over time, the eating or ingestion of gluten damages the villi in the small intestine. The villi in the small intestine are critical to the human body because it is the villi that absorb nutrients from your food or liquids. So When the villi in the small intestines become damaged, the person's ability to absorb vital nutrients or nutrition becomes reduced or non-existent, which is why celiac disease has a relationship to malnutrition. Not all people who have celiac disease or get diagnosed with celiac disease will get diagnosed with malnutrition, but it's somewhat common, and that's why. You could be overweight, you could be obese, you could be morbidly obese, and still have malnutrition. You could still get a diagnosis of malnutrition if you're overweight. Body weight is not the measurement for an indication of malnutrition. Blood testing for nutritional elements is the marker to get diagnosed for malnutrition. Gluten intolerance is slightly different from celiac disease, but very, very similar. And there's not as much research on gluten intolerance. So what I'm going to say about gluten intolerance is someone is typically diagnosed with gluten intolerance when their medical testing does not fulfill the medical requirements for a celiac disease diagnosis. It's very similar in that gluten causes similar problems, similar symptoms, and that is very physician dependent. And so, what can I say? We've certainly learned that there's a lot of agreement in some fields in medicine, and it is what it is. So most of the rest of this podcast, I'm going to be referring to the research on celiac disease because we at least have some. There's limited research on gluten intolerance. And I think some of the information on celiac disease might make that clear why that is. So we're going to begin with the celiac prevalence. Like, how common is celiac disease? Well, it's actually very common and more common than diseases you are very familiar with. The statistical prevalence of celiac disease in the United States is 1 in 133 people. Same as it was back in the day, sadly, because we have a lot of people who aren't diagnosed. Now, they did do a landmark study back in the day on prevalence, how prevalent it is. And this is one thing that is extremely important for you to understand. From the landmark study on prevalence, 60% of the children and 41% of the adults had no symptoms for celiac disease during the study. So that's called being asymptomatic. So 60% of the kids had no symptoms and 41% of the adults had no symptoms. And in the same research, only 35% of the people who were newly diagnosed as celiac had chronic diarrhea. So 65% of the people who were diagnosed with celiac disease during the study had no diarrhea. What's important about that fact is that we have many physicians of all kinds in the U.S. who have a notion or a belief that you have to have diarrhea to have celiac disease. What's also important that is a myth and a misunderstanding is that physicians believe you have to have, if they don't believe you have to have diarrhea, they would believe you have to have a symptom because they're just not awake and aware to the fact that we know from the landmark prevalence study, 60% of the children did not have a symptom and 41% of the adults. So this is one of the issues. Now, according to Peter H. Green et al., from the American Journal of Gastroenterology from 2001, the average time it took from that research for a person with symptoms to get diagnosed was 11 years. And they used to say the physicians and the celiac disease experts who would come to the local support group that I was involved in back in the day, so 23, 24 years ago, 22 years ago, 20 years ago, would say that most always a person with a symptom would go from doctor to doctor to doctor, and it would go on for years before they would get an accurate diagnosis of celiac disease. So this next piece is very important, and I want you to listen for whether any of this applies to you or someone you love or someone you care about. So this is signs, symptoms, and associated with disorders and complications from celiac disease. This information coming from an older Celiac Sprue Association, USA, Inc. fact sheet. Number one. Untreated celiac disease, that means it's undiagnosed or someone's diagnosed but they're not following the diet, increases the risk of miscarriage by 800 to 900%. So if you know someone who's been having issues with miscarriage, I would let them know about this issue pronto. Number two, untreated celiac disease increases the risk of cancer by 200 to 300%. That's someone who is either undiagnosed and doesn't know they have it, or they know they have it and they're not following the gluten-free diet. When they say untreated, meaning not following the diet, which I haven't even covered, but I'll get into. So there's a 200 to 300% increase in cancer for untreated celiac disease individuals. That's the increased risk is 200 to 300%. 51.4% of those with celiac disease have neurologic disorders. And 66% of people with celiac disease have osteopenia or osteoporosis. Now, this next list is a snippet of signs and symptoms or associated conditions or complications. Cancers, infertility, chronic fatigue, malnutrition, heart disease, insomnia, irritable bowel syndrome, headache, migraine, behavior disorders, anemia, depression, anxiety, arthritis, autoimmune disease, diabetes, chronic constipation, chronic diarrhea, irritability, acid reflux, unexplained weight gain or weight loss. That's not even 50 of the 300. So you get the idea that this is one of the underpinnings of why it's not getting diagnosed, is because it's not straightforward like many other diseases. If you have heart disease or some other health issues, it's much more straightforward. So you could have an active case of celiac disease and not be aware of it if you didn't have any symptoms. Now, I will tell you, back in the day when I was in the heyday of the gluten-free and allergy market with my first cookbook, I would frequently get phone calls from people asking for information or requesting help. And one woman called me who had a child who was symptomatic for celiac disease and was requesting information about testing. Well, I happen to know that the FDA had approved a new blood test for celiac disease. So I said, well, you have a pediatric patient, I would recommend a blood test. And I did also strongly recommend that this woman get her entire family tested for celiac disease to rule it out, because we know 60% of children are asymptomatic or without symptoms, and 41% of adults. And that was that. Well, one day the kids and I were going to pick up our organic co-op that was at that time being put laid out at this little train station depot, which was pretty cute. And this woman comes running up to my car after I pulled in. I could barely get out of the car, and she's so animated. And I just looked at her and I thought, I have no idea who you are. And I'm reasonably okay with putting people together. So she's talking, and I finally said, wait a minute, I do not know who you are. And she's like, oh, yes, you do. And I'm like, no, I don't. And then she went, oh, yeah, you've never seen me, we just talked on the phone. And I'm like, okay, now we're making sense. And she tells me she's the woman who had the child, blah, blah, blah. So I'm like, put it together. I'm like, oh, okay, great. Well, what can I do for you? And she said, I am so happy to see you because I wanted to let you know that I took your advice. I not only had my child tested, I had everyone in the family tested. So there were five of us who got tested. My one child who was symptomatic and the rest of us who were not symptomatic. And guess what? I'm like, what? She said, we all tested positive. I'm like, oh my heavens, it was shocking. I mean, it wasn't shocking given the prevalence, and we know that celiac disease runs in families. What was shocking for me was that she actually took my advice and got the rest of the family tested, because that's not what most people will do when they don't have a symptom. Now, the other case that came up or has come up repeatedly is someone will say to me, oh, I'm sure this is someone who hasn't been tested for celiac disease. Oh, I'm sure that I don't have it, or whoever doesn't have it, but it's just the fact that cancer runs in our family. And I would say, well, that's very sure. I'm sure that's true that cancer runs in some families, but we also know that undiagnosed celiac disease also runs in some families until somebody finally gets diagnosed. Then other family members will get tested, and then we realize, oh, it's actually a family who not only has had cancer run in their family, but they also had undiagnosed celiac disease. So when someone tells me that cancer runs in their family, I'm a strong advocate to rule out celiac disease, because you already heard earlier in the podcast, untreated celiac disease increases the cancer risk by 200 to 300%. Testing. So we're going to move on to tests. So you get the idea. There's over 300 signs, symptoms, associated conditions, and complications. This is not straightforward like most other diseases that physicians deal with. And you also are now very awake and aware to the fact that 60% of children don't have any symptoms and 41% of adults, going back to the landmark prevalence study. Testing. Well, I like to stay away from controversy, and so I will tell you that as far as testing goes, number one, there is blood testing and other testing available now. Back in the day, I don't remember the year, but there was the first FDA blood test for celiac disease was FDA approved, which was a very big deal. Now, did the physicians who test for celiac use the blood test? No. So the company at that time was primarily spending their marketing dollars advertising towards parents of children, pediatric patients, who would not normally want to have a biopsy done. So there's blood and other testing means, and then the other option is a biopsy of the small intestine. What you should know about a biopsy of the intestine is that your results are completely going to be contingent and dependent upon the skill and ability of the surgeon doing the biopsy. And some of them do a lot of them and some of them don't. So in many cases, a physician will maybe do a combination. So that's kind of like Pandora's box I'm not getting into, but there are different ways you can get tested. It used to be that the biopsy was really the only thing that physicians wanted to do, and things have changed. So you will have to do your own due diligence about who you believe, what you believe, whether a blood test or some other type of testing is good enough for you. I just can't say any more about that. I could say more about that. I'm unwilling to say more about that. Now, as far as treatment goes, the treatment for celiac disease or gluten intolerance is the removal from gluten from the diet. Now, if you have celiac disease and you remove gluten from your diet, that's gluten from food and beverages, and you really stick to it over time, what normally happens is the villi in your small intestine will repair themselves. So this is, if you had to have a disease, if you had to pick a disease today, 2024, this would not be a bad one. Yes, I'll get into the diet in a minute, but it's not like some other diseases. And if you have diagnosed celiac disease, other than adhering to a strict gluten-free diet, Most physicians is recommended that you have follow-up care, that malnutrition has been ruled out. If you have malnutrition, it's being treated, that you have some follow-up care. And it's going to depend on your physician. So this is a good disease state and condition, gluten intolerance and celiac disease, where you doing your due diligence is extremely important, because back in the day, I had a physician who we'll leave the details out, who told me all I had to do was give a child 2 days of gluten and that would damage their intestine enough to get a reliable biopsy. Well, for a child who's never been eating gluten because it makes them very sick, 2 days of eating gluten is simply not medically enough, nor would it ever be. And I did consult with a famous GI celiac expert who just was appalled and said, no, like, we couldn't tell you how many months it would probably take. It would take months. So there's an instance where somebody who's alleged should know about celiac disease was completely 1,000% wrong. So this is a good area where you do your own due diligence, you do your fact checking, and you make sure that you rule it out. And if you rule it in, that you do your due diligence. So the gluten-free diet. So I will say that I know people moan and groan about the mere idea of removing gluten or wheat or other grains from their diet, just like they moan and groan if they say, when they hear, oh, I could never remove milk or cheese from my diet. I just couldn't do it. I get it, people. I totally get it. Listen, this is coming up on my 25th anniversary of being in the gluten-free market, and I understand. I actually love gluten. Like, I love it like crazy. Unfortunately, gluten does not love me back, which I will take a sidebar note and say, which I didn't say in the testing piece. If you suspect celiac disease, please get tested before you remove gluten from your diet. Please, please, please. Because if you have some symptoms, remove gluten from your diet and your symptoms resolve, and you're off of gluten for long enough, you will not be able to get a reliable test result. So please get tested instead of just doing what I did, which was just go off of gluten. I felt better. And then, you know, a couple years later, I thought, oh, I should have gotten tested, only to find out from a very rock solid expert, no, I would not be able to get a reliable test result now. So it all depends on who you're asking. But I'm going to tell you right now, if you end up having to go on the gluten-free diet, or you're new to the gluten-free diet, it is literally 1,000 times easier in 2024 than it was in 1999. I'm going to tell you that because I had a baby. I had a baby and I would go into this grocery store. I bought up all their gluten-free noodles because the baby didn't have teeth yet. And I could cook the noodles in a organic chicken broth so they would soften up, so it'd be like mush. And I was in a panic because I bought all their noodles and they weren't restocking. And the grocery store clerk just looked at me and said, oh, well, we won't be reordering for months. And I'm like, what do you mean months? So I ended up, by the grace of God and by the kindness and compassion of this grocery store employee who understood I had a baby, this was where I was at, put me in touch with the distributor. And for quite some time, I would place an order with the wholesaler through the distributor and meet the wholesaler distributor truck behind the grocery store, like in the dark alley, only it was daylight, to get my order. Then eventually I made arrangements through a distributor to have it, you know, drop shipped to me. I didn't have to like make arrangements with the truck driver. But that's how bad it was in 1999. And they didn't carry xanthan gum. They didn't even know when I took it in, xanthan gum, which is an ingredient you use for gluten-free baking. It acts as a binder. It's actually in a lot of products that are not gluten-free because it's in salad dressings and lots of things. They were looking at me like, I don't even know what that is. What is that? I said, it's xanthan gum. So this is a very different time because the market has changed so much. People just really weren't aware to the level they are now. Except I've already covered the issues that we have physicians who think you have to have a symptom. We have physicians who think that one of the symptoms has to be diarrhea, you know, and we have physicians who do not understand that you could have migraines and it could be gluten or celiac disease or gluten intolerance. We don't have physicians who understand that depression could be the symptom for celiac disease or gluten intolerance. We just don't have the level of education and awareness. But the good news for you on the gluten-free diet, if you're only in it for a few years or you're just coming into it, I've got really good news for you. So number one, there are a couple things that have made it significantly easier. Number one is food labeling laws. In 1999, the food labeling law was not in place. It was coming, or sometime after 1999, we knew it was coming, but it wasn't in play in 1999. So food labeling wasn't what it is today, and gluten was certainly not labeled. Wheat was not labeled. So the food labeling laws, which were really came into effect in the early 2000s, I'm not sure what year. Were a game changer. Now, even though the food labeling laws, by the way, have changed since then, this is like one of the biggest, best things that could have ever happened to people who had food allergies or who were avoiding wheat or gluten. Now, you still have to read labels, however, because food manufacturers or beverage manufacturers can change their product formulation without warning, and they do. So something that's gluten-free today or free of milk or some other allergen may, in fact, then have an allergen or gluten the next time it's on the shelf. So you still have to read food labels, because products can change and there's no really amazing way of being notified. I mean, there's some groups and systems, but if you're not active in them, you could easily miss it. Now, the other thing that's really been helpful is the increase in demand. Now, I didn't address earlier that some people use the gluten-free diet for weight loss or because it's a fad. I'm not a fan of that because it's expensive, the nutrients aren't the same, etc. However, I cannot sit in judgment. If you do a gluten-free diet to lose weight and you lose weight, good for you. Or you use it because you think it's the right thing, good for you. But the increase in gluten-free products has changed the market 100%. Like, we have so many more choices in 2024 than in 1999 or even 15 years ago. So the increased demand, for whatever reason, has been wildly helpful. I mean, the food manufacturers and the beverage manufacturers of consumer foods and beverages spend a lot of money on marketing to find out what people are buying. And so when the gluten-free diet caught on, if you will, not the gluten-free diagnosis, not the celiac diagnosis. The diagnosis for celiac disease has not shifted. So It used to be they would say 97% of the people in America who have celiac disease are not yet diagnosed. And it looks like that probably has not changed. So the increase in demand was wildly helpful. I can't tell you how many products are now available that weren't even an idea back then. And the other thing that's been very helpful is because of the increase in demand, we now have more restaurants and fast foods and other food service companies and institutions that have gluten-free options. Back in 2002, you know, it was unless the owner of the restaurant had celiac disease or had some relationship, You know, you just couldn't go in and find not only something that was gluten-free, but food allergy-free. So I had a baby, well, that's three, but and they all had some food allergies back in the day. So we had to travel to see a doctor, and I, you know, it was just far enough. So I made arrangements with these fabulous national chain restaurants. The manager would say, I can't feed your child, but if you bring in the food, we'll warm it up. And they did allow that. And then eventually, when the market changed, there were gluten-free, dairy-free, egg-free, peanut-free, tree nut-free, etc. free, commercially made food. And then I would take that into the restaurant and they would warm it up with the proper instructions of a clean plate and how to handle it. So there was no issue of having cross-contamination. So these changes in the market are hugely beneficial to consumers. You know, and the allergy awareness has also been very helpful. So these two things, while they're separate, they have worked very, very nicely together. There's some nice synergy. And I should say, by the way, many people, more than 50%, last I checked, who have celiac disease or gluten intolerance also have either another food allergy or food sensitivity. Now I'm going to talk about, well, under the subject of the gluten-free diet, I'm going to talk about taste and cost. So I have to tell you, besides the increase in availability of gluten-free, commercially made foods and mixes and packaged items, the taste 24 years ago was not nearly as good as it is now. I am not saying that the gluten-free products are on par with a product with gluten. Some of them are or are close, and some of them are no go. And I will say, so back in the day, more than 10 years ago, I had the opportunity to work with a very large institution on the issue of food allergies for their population, which was like, you know, 50,000, and the gluten-free diet. So I had some pre-meetings with the food service staff and the executives and the chefs and all the people who were involved to lay out where are they, what are they doing, how are they handling it, so I could come up with a tailor-made plan on helping them move into offering gluten-free and food allergy-free options for their attendees. Now, so we had the pre-meetings, I got the lay of the land, and then I went back with a cooler full of, I don't remember, it was more than 10 different items to do a taste testing. So I had pre-made them, frozen them, put them in the cooler, made the trip. And then we met in a large conference room. They had the plates and I'm getting things out of the cooler and setting it up. Everybody's in the room sitting in the U-shaped table. And I'm talking to them while I'm pulling the stuff out of the cooler. And I said, well, probably you've never tried gluten-free food, so, and that's as far as I got, and one of the chefs in the back yelled out, oh yes, we did, and it tastes like crap, and everybody laughed, and I was surprised because I was thinking as I was getting stuff out of the cooler, oh, I should have had them do a taste test before I came of what's available, but I didn't think of it. So they're all laughing, I'm laughing, and I said, oh good, that's perfect. This is so perfect, and it was so perfect. So then they got to try homemade, from scratch, my recipes, gluten-free foods. There were dinner rolls, savory rolls, mini muffins, brownies. There was just a whole variety. And they were just stunned. And thank God they had done the taste test of the commercially made foods before, because they wouldn't have had the contrast. But because they did, they were like, oh my, this is like incredible. I said, well, I had a reputation before I ended up in the gluten-free market. I didn't want to ruin my reputation. So you typically can get a better tasting and a better textured food if you're willing to make it yourself. usually. Now, today in the market, they sell one-to-one gluten-free flour mixes, which weren't available back in the day. You had to mix up your own. And you can do that, or you can still mix up your own. But your taste is going to depend on either what you're buying or what you're making. But I'm telling you, you can get gluten-free foods to taste amazing and as good as a gluten food. Because in the early days before the gluten-free market was popular or acceptable, I took gluten-free brownies to a meeting, which had nothing to do with gluten-free. And I didn't tell the people that the brownies were gluten-free because I thought they won't eat them if they think they're gluten-free, because nobody had heard of gluten-free. So they're chowing down. We're having this meeting. The meeting's going well. They're chowing down on the brownies. They're loving the brownies. Nobody has said, oh, these taste different. Oh, what's different about? Nobody has said a word. So I thought, oh, I don't think they know. Do they know? I'm thinking, should I tell them? So eventually, when the brownie plate is almost gone, I decide it's probably okay to tell them now. And I did. And one guy had his mouth full of a brownie and said, I don't care what the blop, blop, blop you made these from. They are delicious. I thought, oh. So you really can get great foods. Now, it's more difficult if you have to be gluten-free, dairy-free, egg-free, peanut-free, tuna-free, etc. free, as I started out. So, but you can still get a great food with all of those allergens out. So if you're only gluten-free, you know, and you can use butter or eggs or milk, oh my gosh. But even if it's gluten-free, dairy-free, egg-free, you can still have very good products. Now, the cost, gluten-free foods or the gluten-free ingredients. Well, the gluten-free foods are significantly more expensive. Restaurants usually have an upcharge if they're offering a gluten-free bun. And the scratch ingredients, if you're going to bake or cook with gluten-free ingredients, are typically more expensive. I mean, they've always been more expensive. They're still more expensive. Back in the day, you could get a tax break if you spent enough on food to qualify. I haven't followed that enough to know because I don't qualify. But, and they've changed the tax deductions, like, so anyway. But it is more expensive. Now, my experience has been when I do things from scratch, I'm really, you know, doing very well on saving money, because I can make for, you know, little money a lot more. So you'll get a better taste. If you're willing to do it from scratch, you can get a much better taste. You know, you can save money, and it's amazing. So that's that. Now, cross-contamination. Cross-contamination is an issue if you have food allergies to the IgE level, like a serious food allergy. And it's also an issue with the gluten-free diet. However, like so many things, now I'm not talking about allergies now, I'm talking about the gluten-free diet. There are differing opinions about the acceptable level, the process, the procedures for in the area of cross-contamination when it comes to the gluten-free diet. And there has been a lack of agreement and controversy since 1999. Now, how much further before that, I don't know. But I can tell you, since 1999, there has not been agreement about the process, how to handle it, what level's acceptable. I mean, I sat in gluten-free celiac community meetings, support group meetings, and heard two different experts say two different things about the acceptable level for cross-contamination. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. Of course, then eventually oats went from taboo, you can never have them, to now you can have them if they stay gluten-free and other people say no. So as far as cross-contamination, I'm simply going to say that if it were me, I would look it up online, look at various sources, and then make your decision based on what you've read, or talk to your doctor, or whoever you trust. I don't know. The opposing points of view, the gap is too wide for me to comment. All right, so have some final thoughts on the gluten-free and celiac disease podcast here. So number one, I strongly urge you to rule this out if, number one, you have any type of health issue. although I covered some of the very common signs, symptoms, complications, and associated conditions, there's over 300, and I didn't even cover 50. So if you have some health issue, this would be the perfect thing to rule out. You might have celiac disease, or you might not, or you might have gluten intolerance, or you might not, but this would be a great thing to rule out. Number two, if cancer runs in your family, I would run and make sure that you and your family members do not have celiac disease. That's number two. Number three, if anyone that you are biologically or genetically related to ends up with a positive diagnosis, I would absolutely get this ruled out. Now, what we know from back in the day is sometimes when a family member gets a positive diagnosis of celiac disease and they get their children tested, or the child gets a diagnosis, they get the parent tested, they test negative. But what they found was if they retest the patient 2 or 4 or 5 years later, then that patient tests positive. So if it runs in your family or someone gets a positive diagnosis, number one, I would rule it out. And number two, it would not harm you to a couple years in or whatever to periodically just double check, because you do understand 41% of adults are going to be symptomatic. Number two, do your own research and get educated. You've already gotten the idea this has been, there's been some controversy, there have been changes. In this area in particular, given the level of knowledge of physicians, your best option, or one option, I'm going to give you another option in a second, is to do your own research and get educated. Now, I know a lot of people aren't going to like that, but let me give you an option number three. Number three is, if you want to have a physician who is almost 100 times more likely to be highly educated in both celiac disease and the gluten-free or gluten intolerance, my suggestion is that you seek out either an integrative, holistic, naturopath, or functional medicine, as well as environmental physicians. They are usually, almost always, highly trained in both celiac disease and gluten intolerance. If you go to a physician like that, you don't have to do so much work. You just have to find a good one and, you know, deal with that. That number four, I already mentioned this, but this is worth mentioning again. If you suspect that gluten or wheat or something in the wheat genre is bothering you, please get tested before you go off. Or if you go off for 2 or 3 days and you're like, oh my gosh, I feel so much better, get on board with finding the kind of doctor you want to see. You'll have to eat and get right back on gluten and get tested. Number five, I don't think I could say this enough. This is probably the third or fourth time I've said this in the podcast, but this is one of the issues in America. And by the way, other parts of the world are way different about gluten intolerance and celiac disease. Like, I remember in like 2000 reading on this online gluten-free forum that Europe, some of parts of Europe, McDonald's had gluten-free hamburger buns. And I thought, oh my Lord, like different parts of the world are way more ahead of their diagnosis rates and having availability of products and testing. But remember, 60%, according to the prevalence, landmark prevalence study I mentioned, 60% of children and 41% of adults are not going to have symptoms. Number six, read labels because products can change. Number seven, all right, well, number seven is your mindset, attitude, or perspective will set the tone if you find out that wheat or gluten is a problem. Now, when I first discovered that this was likely an issue, in 1999, and I was reading up on it, that doctors weren't like hip to it, like they're still mostly not, excepting those ones I mentioned, I was thinking to myself, oh my gosh, well, if this is it and all I have to do is change their diet and the symptom resolves, I'm going to be a hallelujah because it's better than cancer. It's better than leukemia. It's better than a brain tumor. It's better than this. It's better than that. It's better than all these things. If it's only food, I'm a hallelujah. And luckily, it was only food. So my mindset was, hey, this is obviously not easy, but it is better than the alternative. So whatever your mindset is that you bring into it, it's going to give you your reality and your future. Number 8, make requests for menu changes if the restaurants you frequent or the places you like to eat don't have gluten-free options, or if they don't have enough gluten-free options. And sometimes, you know, you have to work with people, but make requests. Or you might have to change where you go. Number 9, don't assume that your restaurant server or waiter or waitress is up to speed. Ask questions. If you're unclear, then please ask to speak to the manager and or cook or chef. Now, because I was dealing with not only gluten-free, but anaphylactic life-threatening food allergies, I had to make sure that in a restaurant setting, when they were providing part of the meal or, you know, some foods, that it was absolutely not going to carry the food allergen that could kill my child. So I had to have a higher level of diligence than if I was just doing gluten-free for myself. But many chefs, many managers are more than willing to help you. And if they can't, I did have some restaurant owners or managers, not too many, say to me, yeah, I'm just not interested. So, okay. Now, number 10, this is for you to know because this could be helpful going back to number 8, make requests, which is Sysco, major food distributor, manufacturer for food institutions. So they service hospitals and nursing homes and colleges and schools. Like Sysco is huge, and there are many other companies besides Sysco, but Sysco, at least I know, carries a gluten-free and dairy-free hamburger bun. It used to be also egg-free. And restaurants who don't know that, when they find out that, they're like, oh, wow, because they can change their menu easily by just changing their Sysco order. So let your restaurant know that. Sysco has gluten-free hamburger buns, and they're not bad. Number 11, there are in-person celiac and gluten-free support groups. There are many online groups, which can be wildly helpful, just extremely helpful to stay up to date with what's come out, what's new, what's this restaurant doing, what's that restaurant doing. They're just wildly helpful, and they've always been wildly helpful going back to 1999. All right, number 12. For parties or other events or places where you will be, which could also be at work, where food is going to be present, my recommendation, and you'll have to figure this out for yourself, but I wouldn't expect them, well, it's different now because so much has changed, but you wouldn't necessarily expect them to have gluten-free foods. If it's a party or a potluck or personal kind of event like that, I always take my own casserole dishes or whatever and desserts and dips and things to share so that I know I have foods that I can eat that won't be a problem. But I also have issues beyond gluten, like MSG, and I'm allergic to blue cheese and so blah, blah, blah. So it's really great to take something to share as opposed to trying to expect your host or hostess to meet your food needs. And I know there are people who just like are kind of demanding, but I found it very helpful to just take my own foods. And quite frankly, I'll be honest with you, I have a life-threatening food allergy to tree nuts and coconut. And I have been served both at a restaurant, multiple restaurants, and by a former friend, the foods I was allergic to. Now, none of them did it on purpose. Well, the former friend might have, but notice the former friend. The restaurant certainly did not do it on purpose. So if you're going somewhere, consider taking things to share or your own foods if you don't want to share. All right, now, number 13, as I just kind of alluded to, even with your best due diligence, there might be a period or times where you get gluten by accident, or in my case, tree nuts by accident. I mean, I'm laughing. It's not funny, but if I take a bite of a food that has a tree nut, like the one gala I was at, the dessert was like this chocolate torte, and I took one bite, and I just knew, like it was a small bite, and I had already talked to the staff and the manager for the banquet. They knew. I took one bite and I absolutely knew it had some type of nut. So I put my fork down. I said to the woman sitting next to me, "Hey, I'm pretty sure this has some type of tree nut or something I'm allergic to, but I think it's in the, can I just cut off where I bit off and do you want to finish my dessert?" And she was like, "Oh, yes, happily." So she ate my dessert, gives me the empty plate back. And then the wait staff came running out with the manager and they were like, "Oh my God, did you eat that? Oh my God, it had like almonds and whatever." And I said, "No, I didn't eat it." And they were like, "Oh, thank God." So even when you do your due diligence, you might be served something that you are allergic to. So you just, it's kind of a buyer beware market. And when it's, you have a life-threatening food allergy, hopefully, if you're like me, develop a sensitivity where like my mouth starts to itch the minute I get something that I shouldn't be eating, except for gluten. That doesn't happen with gluten. Now, number 14, please, if you're going to eat out or be in an environment, please be kind and sweet about special orders or instructions or asking for gluten-free or whatever food allergies. Like, please just be kind. I mean, people are typically doing the best they can, and we don't need, you know, grumpy people ordering gluten-free or allergies actually either. All right, 15. In this day and age in 2024, you heard earlier that the miscarriage rate is 800 to 900% higher in people who have untreated celiac disease. Do you not agree with me that this is a tragic, tragic situation, that fact is not common knowledge? It is not common knowledge. Not only is it not common knowledge, I did a press release about that over, well, it was like 2009 or 10, that still you could find it under my name and infertility and miscarriage. And there was a woman who read the news release back in the day, went in and talked to her OBGYN. The OBGYN said, "Oh my gosh, how could it possibly hurt you to go off of the gluten-free diet? If that's what it takes for you to carry a baby to term, let's do it." And that's what happened. She went on the gluten-free diet, and she was able to carry to term, although she did call me. Her doctor told her to call me. I forget. She might have been 6 months pregnant, but anyway, she was fairly well along, and the doctor, she was having trouble gaining weight. So the doctor, her OBGYN, said, "Hey, well, call that girl that put up that news release. I mean, like, this is the farthest you've ever gotten in a pregnancy. She seems to know everything about food. Call her." So she did call me. And that's how I found out that she was on the gluten-free diet and the farthest along she'd ever been. And I said, "Oh, well, if you're having trouble gaining weight," I said, "this is what I do when I'm consulting with a parent who has a failure to thrive infant. Number one, you've got to carb load like crazy." I said, "because when it's a failure to thrive infant, typically the physician or hospital or whoever's involved medically in a failure to thrive infant or toddler, it's usually infants, but sometimes it's toddlers, will give the parent a very short window, like 2-3 days or some very short window that the infant has to gain so many ounces. Like it's really, it's very harsh, but I understand." And so when I dealt with those parents, every time it worked, carb load, get carbs in that baby like crazy. So I did let her know that this always works. And luckily, you know, I had a cookbook so she could make her own stuff. But is this not tragic that we have so many people who are struggling with infertility or miscarriage or miscarriages as under the umbrella of infertility who could benefit by knowing that fact. So my request is that you help get this information out to the public so that, because infertility is the suffering in infertility. Men and women who are dealing with infertility, it's tragic. It is horrific. And miscarriage is over the top. And this is one of the underpinnings for some people. It's not the reason everyone has a miscarriage, but this should be known. So share this podcast. The other piece in this share this podcast is we have people walking around thinking that cancer just runs in their family, like it's inevitable, when the reality could be, and an operative word is could be, that undiagnosed celiac disease is actually what is going on in their family. Shouldn't this be common knowledge? I would think this should like ignite the movement to get people tested and rule it out. We raise so much money for cancer. To me, it is criminal that this statistic of a 200 to 300% increase in an undiagnosed, the cancer risk being 200 to 300% higher in an undiagnosed celiac disease should be something that everyone in America and everyone in the world knows. It should just be one of those things that we all know, because then people would just get tested, ruled out, because they'd want to bring their cancer risk down by 200 or 300%. Of course you would. All right, number 16. So I already mentioned this, but it's very common, extremely common, for individuals who have either celiac disease or gluten intolerance to have another food sensitivity. So that kind of, let me just wrap it up to say, look, I understand exactly what life is like if you are on a gluten-free diet, whether it's from celiac disease or gluten intolerance. Since I'm coming up in 25 years, oh, I definitely understand. And I don't know what you're thinking about it, but if everybody had to sign up for a disease tomorrow, I don't know what you'd sign up for, but this would be the top of my list. Because if you change your diet, make sure you have the right nutrition, though you don't have malnutrition, this is not bad. In my opinion. Now, if you'd rather choose cancer, diabetes, or, you know, some autoimmune disease, you can go do that. If you're struggling with your emotions on this, then deal with your emotions. I have a free emotional processing workbook on my website, because some people get a diagnosis of celiac disease or gluten intolerance and they go to a dark place. And you may do that. But if you get my emotional processing workbook and deal with your emotions on it so that you can process your sadness or your loss or what have you, whatever you're feeling, then you can move to a different place. So please share this podcast on social media from the cancer standpoint, from the infertility, from the miscarriage standpoint, and from the standpoint of the prevalence of people who do not have a symptom. And for other reasons. But anyway, I do love you. That's it for now. I'm Lisa Lundy saying thank you for listening to my Love Life podcast, episode number 228, Gluten Intolerance and Celiac Disease. I hope you heard in this podcast, I'm giving a call of urgency to share this because we have valid factual information that could really change people's lives. Let me know if you need anything else. I do love you. That's it for now.